Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome to October. It's kind of nice, ain't it? We are officially, I get to declare it, on the Gulf Coast, we are officially in fall. Throughout Alabama, we are officially in fall. I think on the Gulf Coast, fall basically starts about October 15th. The big white pelicans are in, you know, they're back, they're making big squadrons. That's your signal that it's about to start. And they usually come in, what, the last week in September, first week in October. You begin to see them over the causeway. I guarantee you'll see them now. Maybe we're going to get a little bit of clarity out of the Delta, too. But the temperatures are going to drop. It's going to be a nice October. Maybe even some color this year. I'm kind of excited about it. It's that time. It's October. It is fall, officially, along the Gulf Coast. I hope you're ready for it. A couple of things we'll talk about today. There's a plant sale going on. I think that's Saturday and Sunday. Somebody can call me and jump on me if I'm wrong, but it's Saturday and Sunday coming up this next week. It's, you know, the plant sales have changed a little bit because it's best to order the plants before you go. And I would go online at mobilebotanicalgardens.org. And order those plants. There's some great stuff there that we talk about on the show a lot, as my friend John Olive tells me and reminds me. Thanks, John, for doing that. Some great material there to purchase. So that's coming up this coming weekend. It's a great time of year to plant. No problems with planting this time of year. I don't recommend planting citrus this time of year. Hold on to your citrus. Let's do that in March and April. Don't do it this time of year. But everything else, virtually everything else, I just go ahead and get it planted this time of year. Palms you could might want to hold off on too, depending on what kind of palms. But everything else. I hate to give the exceptions because almost everything benefits from being planted this time of year. If you're going to do your lawn, you know, I've told people call me in the middle of summer and say, I want to fix my lawn. I say, well, call me back in October. It's time to call me back if you want to fix your lawn. This is the time of year to do it. I'm not saying you need to fix your lawn. I'm not saying you should even put a lot of thought into your lawn. But if you're putting too much thought into your lawn and you think you need to fix it, this is the time to do it. So, a couple of other things. Charlie's back. Some of you may have recognized that. It's nice to have him back. Charlie, say something. Yeah, thank you, Bill. Buddy.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be back. I'm trying to remember which button to push and which thing to turn off and turn on. But it sure is good to hear you.
Yeah, you too.
And so I decided not to do a fall garden this time. Spring garden just about whipped me.
Well, it's good. But, you know, just fall is the easy time. It's the easiest time. It's the time you'll put the least effort into it. There's still a few things you can plant, and we can talk about those. You can give me a call on those. You know, I did want to talk a little bit about trees today. Here's where I'm coming from. It's striking to me. We've all become lounge chair druids. And what do I mean by that? I mean, it means we have this kind of weird, not very thoughtful, not very religious worship of trees. And people in the suburbs do it. People in the, you know, people in the cities do it. Hunters do it. They all worship trees. It's craziness. And I'm not saying you can't be a pantheist. You ought to be a pantheist if you want to be one. You ought to be a druid if you want to be one. But I spend my life thinking about trees. I spend a lot of time thinking about trees. I mean, I, you know, it's part of my job. I gotta know, I do my best. I try to know 40 species of oaks and how to identify them in the field, plus a few others that I have to deal with that crazy people plant, like the kind of useless Japanese sawtooth oak. I have to be able to – I got all these hickories I got to identify. Man, it's scary. You know, you're going to make a – I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to be – somebody's going to make a fool of me, but I got 12 species of hickories I got to know. How many of those can you identify? I mean, it's big, and some of them are sweet, some of them are not. I got to know all these ash trees. I got to know all these elm trees. I got to know all these magnolia species. And I try my best, and trees are a big part of my life. I wrote a book about trees. It's the longleaf pine ecosystem. Though the book was about the ecosystem as much as it was about the trees, I really understand trees about as well as a poor little guy like me who hadn't had a lot of training and who's not very smart. You know, I do my best to understand trees. But I'll also tell you, the more I study trees, the more I recognize they ain't angels. If you think a tree is an angel, you have missed the point. They're not angels at all. In fact, here's the important thing that you need to remember. Trees are really important. It drives me crazy when people cut down trees without thinking about what they were doing. It pains me, it angers me when I see people over in Baldwin County cutting down white cedar forests and piling them up and burning them. It's insane. It drives me crazy when people cut longleaf. It's just crazy. But let me tell you, trees are not angels. They're just trees. And they're not the sum total of the world we live in. They're bullies. That's an important thing to know about trees. They're bullies. And I don't hold it against them that they're bullies. It's just they're trying to make a living just like everybody else. But if you don't understand that trees are bullies sometimes, you're going to miss what it is to be in Alabama. I was thinking about this the other day because somebody said, somebody was writing about how many endangered species we have in Alabama and how many species went extinct. So, you know, you may have heard me say that we had 10 species on the mainland of the U.S. were declared extinct a few weeks ago by Fish and Wildlife. 9 of those were in Alabama. 9. Man, that's scary. That's scary. Huge extinction rates. And so somebody said, you know, we got to quit cutting all these trees. But it ain't that we're cutting trees that's the problem. And in fact, in many cases, and I'm just going to give you an example. In many cases, the plants, the things that are now rare, the quail that are now rare, the Bachman's warbler that's now declared extinct, many of the rarest birds that we have, the grassland birds, the gopher tortoise, the indigo snakes, these incredible creatures, the fox squirrels, they're rare, they're endangered, not because we're cutting down trees, but because we have too many trees. We have a thicket of trees. We have trees that don't really benefit wildlife at all. They're just thickets of trees. And so one thing we have to learn is that a tree isn't more sacred than a sunflower. A tree isn't better than grasses, than wild native grasses for wildlife. If hunters think, oh, I'm gonna manage this forest for mast trees because it's good for the deer, they miss the point. Because mast plays a relatively small role and what deer eat along the Gulf Coast. Don't worship trees. Understand trees. Understand how they work. That's one of the things we ought to talk about. If you're a tree worshiper and you think I'm wrong, well, let's talk about it this morning. Let's give a little call. It's one of the problems in our gardens, too. We've over-worshipped trees, and then you call me and say, I can't get my grass to grow. Quit worshiping your trees. Let's think about trees as fellow travelers. Hey, we'll be back. Give us a call this morning. 251-343-0106. We'll talk about your garden. We'll talk about your trees. We'll talk about, oh, man, we'll even talk about your lawn. We could talk about a lot of cool things. Give us a call.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night too.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. I get hard questions and I get easy questions. One of the hard questions this morning I'll start out with is, I got a picture of a mushroom. And it's on a pecan. And I'm gonna guess, it's not a guess entirely, it's a reasonably educated guess that it is armillaria, honey fungus, what do they call it, honey mushroom. Don't let the name honey take you in the wrong direction. It ain't no honey. Armillaria is kind of edible. Not all that good, and it will make a lot of people sick, so I don't recommend eating it. When you see it showing up around plants, it's really common, armillaria, honey fungus. You see it all the time in lawns. It usually, when it's on its, maybe we could say, when it's on its best behavior, it only eats dead wood, but it is one of those fungi, a type of fungus that can go from dead wood to live wood at the drop of a hat. And armillaria, so if you were to cut a water oak, for example, which is a typhoid Mary, a typhoid Tom of disease carriers, it's just, they're terrible. They carry all sorts of diseases. And we've allowed them to spread. You remember I said something about worshiping trees. One of the worst trees that we worshiped, or one of the worst, when we victimized ourselves most, is when we worship water oaks. Water oaks are fine trees. They had their place. We worshiped them and allowed them to go everywhere. And they have spread disease to all sorts of trees. It makes it even hard to grow certain kinds of shrubs because of water oaks and the disease they carry. But one of them is armillaria root rot, and it's a really serious disease. It looks like it's armillaria, and it will infect trees. Pecan is one of those trees that doesn't have a good immune system. It's not as bad as water oaks, but it still does not have a great immune system. It's one of the soft hickories. Pecan, yes, is a hickory. It's a soft hickory. That means the wood is soft. It doesn't partition wood is doesn't partition rot off as well as some other hickories, and it can be really susceptible. So I think it probably does have armillary root rot. What do you do about it? Nothing. You can't get rid of it. It's in your lawn everywhere. You'll have to hope that the tree can handle this. And there's a good chance that the pecan will. One of the things you want to avoid doing is damaging roots. And that means driving over the tree roots, which may spread 50 feet from the tree. It means digging trenches. It means digging sidewalks within 25 feet of the tree. All of that can do a lot of damage to the tree, and it can spur an armillaria infestation and infestation of a lot of different diseases, and they can spread throughout the whole tree. That's my best guess on that one. It looks a lot like armillaria. I have a picture here of a tree that someone is asking me to identify. And here's the key, and this is really important, Alan. Go out. First off, this is how you will never be able to forget this tree. Alan, go out and grab some leaves. Crush them in your hand. I mean, just be rough with them. Crush them up in your hand and hold them up to your nose. Sniff. Tell me what you smell. That smell is a very distinctive smell. It lets you know that that tree is what we commonly call a camphor tree. It's in the cinnamon family. It's in the Asian family of cinnamon-producing trees. Don't confuse this with a cinnamon-producing tree, however. It's only related. It's a camphor tree. It is very invasive. It's particularly in suburban areas. I don't see it in the woods. That's kind of odd. I'm not sure I understand that as well. It's never gotten in the woods that badly, but it is really invasive in Midtown and cities and Daphne and places like that where humans... It seems to like the smell of humans. And so you need to learn the smell. How'd you like that? You need to learn the smell of camphor trees. I don't think they're great yard trees because you will never have one. There is no such thing as one camphor tree. You will always have, if you have one, you will have dozens and sometimes hundreds. And they will come up repeatedly. So you gotta. It's probably good to get them while they're young, learn that smell, learn that appearance, because they're really very difficult to deal with. They cast a lot of shade. They're not good for. They don't play well with other trees. They don't play well with other plants. You end up with just a big camphor tree thicket, which is not the most pleasant thing in the world. Camphor trees. Another one, you know, I think it probably has I'd be interested to see how it grows in Vietnam and in southern China where it's native. I think probably there are things that sort of hold it in check there, that keep it from being such a nuisance. Here we don't have those things, and it is a total nuisance. Camphor trees. Let's see what else we got. That's kind of caught up on questions. Have I done it? Yes. And you can look up, the person who asked me about the armillaria can look it up. If you see some more of it coming up, take a picture of it while it's younger. I'm pretty sure that this is, it's honey root rot. It's armillaria. So there's no question there. Can we talk a little bit about trees? You know, it's very interesting the other day, and we worship trees, and I keep telling us we shouldn't. I get in trouble from people who do worship trees. And I don't think it's, you know, I think I understand exactly why people, I think I have a good idea why people worship trees. We're told to worship trees, particularly by people up north where trees grow very slowly and it can be hard to come by. We're told to worship trees by people who get irritated by huge suburbs where they bulldoze everything down and you're left with nothing but, you know, grass, and not even good grass, just sorry old lawn grass, St. Augustine and centipede and Bermuda grass that doesn't matter really, except to be walked on. Not much diversity, and it really can be depressing in those big suburbs where there are no trees. And so I understand all that. I think we worship trees because they're bigger than us. We're always impressed with things that are big, right? And that's good. And I appreciate that. And it's good to know. You know, trees create their own environment, and that's something you really need to understand. But you got to understand the trees are just one component of the world. Just one component. And trees, if they have their way, if they don't have the checks and balances, like we said with the camphor trees, they just eliminate everything else. They can be really bad that way. And one of the interesting things about people is that we've encouraged trees that, like camphor trees, and like water oaks, which we talked about just a minute ago, and live oaks, I didn't say that out loud, did I? We encourage trees like live oaks, water oaks, camphor trees that are weedy. I said it out loud. They're weedy, and they come up everywhere. They're very common, really abundant. And you know what happens? They're gorillas. They're bullies. They are the very trees that do the most because they're evergreen, because they have a very dense canopy, because they spread as much as they possibly can. They eliminate virtually everything else. They turn what could be a rich forest into a sterile forest. Big problem. Big problem. Something to think about. We don't need to worship trees. You know, I'm going to tell you something else. And we're going to be running out of time here, but I'm going to come back and I'm going to talk about some surprising things. One of the other reasons we love trees is because we see them as being old. Older than us. In many cases, most of the trees you look like are not even as old as I am. We'll come back. We're going to talk about age here in just a minute.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, we're back. I'm thinking about trees. I don't know if you want to think about trees. But I'm also thinking about all the things that trees grow with and that trees companion with. And because the world is not made of trees, if the world had to live on trees by itself, we would be a really poor place. Because trees are bullies. I got to be honest. They just are. And that doesn't mean they're bad, I guess. It doesn't mean they're bad. But they're not angels, for sure. They're just sort of fellow travelers making a living, trying to get by. It's good to understand that about trees. It's good to understand that if you've got a rare tree, if you've got white cedars, oh, man, on the property you bought, please protect them. They become so rare. The wood is so incredible. It was one of the great woods of the Gulf Coast. It was what we made our boats out of. It was this incredible stuff. And we're just, you know, we have so little sensitivity to what we, where we are and to what these things are worth that we bulldoze them down. And then we plant something like live oaks, or we allow water oaks to come in. And they're dime a dozen trees. They're really abundant. They are prolific spreaders. They are the worst of the bullies. Live oaks didn't used to be that way, but we created a habitat where we created a kind of a situation where live oaks just take over. Like we created situations where camphor trees take over and water oaks take over. It's not a good situation. But thinking about trees, how good they are, how beneficial they are. They do wonderful things. They can provide shade. They may or may not keep you cooler in summer, depending on the humidity. I'm kind of torn by that. sometimes they keep the humidity higher than it would be, which can be very unpleasant in some cases. They're really great things. They're wonderful things. They're bigger than us. That's really impressive. But the world is not made of trees. It's got lots of other things. It has lots of other things we need. Oh, if you've got, you know, if just on the most basic level of sort of our grocery store lives, it's, you know, you got to have corn. You got to have wheat. You have all of these incredible grasses that are incredibly important to life. And the grasses that are important to our lives, like wheat and corn, barley, oats, they're all grasses. They're important to our lives as humans, and grasses are incredibly important to the rest of nature as well. As important, the grasses are in most cases as important, if not more important than trees in many situations. Let me tell you, it's good to think about what Alabama once looked like, because it's very interesting. Alabama was mostly a savanna. And I want you to think about that. If savanna is a word that you associate with Africa, that's kind of how you have to think about Alabama. It was a place of grasslands with scattered trees. I think our trees were probably closer together in the original forests than they would be in Africa, but much farther apart than you see in most forests now. And plenty of sunlight hitting the ground, which made it great for quail. Wonderful things. And not just the grasses, but the sunflowers. Sorry for being obsessive about sunflowers. And the goldenrods. And the false foxgloves. And the asters. And all those incredible things that are blooming now in places where we get enough sun and we don't mow. It's really an interesting thing. That's where the life of a forest is often in the ground layer, not in the canopy. Same thing in your yard. Can be hard to manage. If you worship trees in your yard, if you think trees are more important than anything else in your yard, you kind of have missed the boat. You've missed the boat in terms of gardening. Trees are bullies. They're gorillas. I will say, one of the things we really like trees, one of the reasons we really like trees, I think, is because we see them as older than we are. And we make a huge mistake there. Because in most cases, the trees you're looking at, even the big live oaks, they're not as old as I am. That's crazy, isn't it? Now, I'm old. I know I'm old. I'm getting older by the day. But in most cases, those trees are not that old. They grow fast on the Gulf Coast. We hadn't figured out where we live. We live in a place where trees grow really fast unless something intervenes, unless something stops them from growing that really, really, really fast. And that's not always a good thing. Most of the live oaks we see in downtown are not old at all. Most of the ones in Midtown, probably, again, not even 60 years old. Many of them are 25 to 50 years old at most. That's how fast things grow. That's how fast trees can grow. But, you know, here's an interesting thing. Trees can sometimes get old. Longleaf pines can live to be an incredibly old age. Incredibly old age. They can live to be easily 200, 300, 400 years old. We have examples of 500-year-old longleaf pines. They're incredibly stable trees that can live a really long time, something really to respect. And the size is no indication of the age sometimes. Sometimes the oldest trees are not even the biggest trees by any means. But they can live a long time. But, you know, here's an interesting thing. So I'm walking through a longleaf forest, and we're talking about the age of the trees. And I'm looking at a clump of big bluestem that has managed to survive there. Big bluestem grass. One of the great grasses of Alabama. Incredibly important forage for bison and elk. Cows love it. Horses love it. It's one of the best forages for horses you could have. Horses loved it and cows loved it so much that they ate it out because we didn't manage it very well. We weren't thoughtful about it. But it's incredible forage. And I'm looking at that clump and I'm realizing, you know, that clump of big bluestem is probably as old as these pines. That's probably, that clump of bluestem is probably 150, 200 years old. And if you don't think it's really important to have a 200-year-old grass in your pasture, you've missed it. It's as important as having a 200-year-old tree. Really important. These old, old grasses that, if we allow them to survive, can be really important. Don't worship trees. They're just fellow travelers. There's lots of other things in the world. Hey, and I've got a caller. Got a couple of callers. Sandy, I'm listening. What's going on?
Well, I've got several beds of Asiatic jasmine, and I've had them for years and years. And one bed has just completely died this summer. It's about two feet deep, but I mean, it is dead. I've taken pictures of it in the dyeing process, and I never knew you could even kill that stuff.
Yeah, I didn't. It is really hard to kill Asiatic jasmine. And it's possible. It is possible that it is completely dead. More than likely, it is suffering from something that I'm going to call the Asiatic jasmine funk. Because I never remember the right name for it. But it's a funk that Asiatic jasmine gets. That is usually the result. I think it's a fungal organism that, when Asiatic jasmine gets really thick and hasn't been cut back in a while, that funk will spread through the Asiatic jasmine and defoliate it and make it look really bad. I suppose it could kill it in an extreme situation. When we have a lot of rainfall, if it's gotten very thick, it could kill it. If it does, I want to bottle it. So if it did kill that Asiatic jasmine, I want to put it in a bottle and I'm going to sell it, because a lot of people are trying to get rid of Asiatic jasmine and don't know how. I've tried for many years. More than likely, that clump is going to come back and it will begin to sprout this spring, and you call me if it doesn't. One thing you need to do with Asiatic jasmine, if you want to be persistent with it, is to take a weed whacker, pretty tough weed whacker, and go in maybe about every 5 or 6 years, and I would do it probably, I'd do it in probably March or early April, late March or early April, when it can recover quickly, and you just cut it down, just cut it as hard as you can, kind of thins it out, gets rid of some of the old foliage. It keeps that funk from developing, and do that about every 5 years.
Okay.
And you'll get, so on your other Asiatic jasmine, you might want to go ahead and cut that back. Get somebody to cut it back for you so that funk doesn't spread to the other. If you see little brown spots develop in the other clumps, you know that funk is developing, that fungal infection is developing. And you just go ahead and cut those back, and it'll stop it from spreading. And with the clump that's dead, I think it'll come back. Okay. If it doesn't come back, Sandy, you need to call me and tell me.
Okay. Well, I have had it cut back, weed whack, way down low to get rid of all that dead on the top.
That's right.
I love it in my beds, and I mean, it's beautiful. It's been there for 10 or 15 years, and it's real spread out. It grows well in the sun and in the shade, so it makes a beautiful ground cover if you're out on acreage like we are.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right. Well, it does.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, just give it a trim. It'll and more than likely it's going to come back. I've never been able to kill it. So
thank you so much.
Thank you, and keep me posted if you have any problems with it. Have we got to, if Charlie? We don't have time for Larry this break, do we? Let's Larry, can you hold on just a minute? Because boy, October grass, I want to talk about it. We're going to be back. We got a few seconds here before the break, and then we're going to be back. So give me a call, 251-343-0106. I got lots of texts I got to work on. I'm working on them. I'm coming. Hold on.
There's a fly in the window, a dog in the yard, and the years since I saw you. There's a trunk in the corner. I keep all my letters, my bills, and the demands I keep too. But I can't help thinking about the times. You are a wife of mine. You have to please me. Look black, I please me. Meet Elderberry Wayne.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yes, welcome back. J. Jim, tell me where that Jim in Georgetown sent me a picture of a tree. Tell me where the picture was taken. Tell me where that picture was taken. It'll help me a little bit to figure out what it is. Cynthia, boy, I'm so glad you asked me about this. And it's a beautiful tree. She sent me a picture of this beautiful, beautiful tree that has the undersides of the leaves are kind of a reddish purple. Their top is green. And Cynthia, you know, it's always good to smell. Use that nose. It's evergreen, like camphor trees, but you're going to smell it. And it doesn't smell like camphor. It smells like bay leaves. It smells like the bay leaves you've got in your cabinet. It is an increasingly rare tree. It's called the red bay tree. It is our native red bay. It was the bay that we used for cooking along the Gulf Coast before we went to the grocery store and got bay leaves from California. It was the bay leaves that everyone assumed you would use in your recipes when you were cooking Cajun cooking along the Gulf Coast, right? Creole cooking. That was the bay leaf. And it grew wild all across the South. It was really abundant, really important to us. And so crush it and smell it. It's really important. We introduced a disease called laurel wilt, which is killing our bay trees. I can't tell whether your tree is suffering from it yet. It may. It will come back as a shrub, we hope, in most cases. We may lose the trees, but we hope we will be able to retain at least the shrubs. Really an important thing. Jim, that looks like arbutus, but I will look it up here in a minute. That was good. We were different trees. So I believe that is an arbutus, but let me look. This looks like something from California, was it? John sent me a picture of a cactus, and I want to say, John, first off, don't water it. It's a Christmas cactus. It's easy to overwater them, and as they move from place to place, they can get really stressed. Go easy on the watering. Make sure that the top really dries out really well before you water it again, ease into it. It probably won't like the lack of humidity in the house either, but you know it's kind of time to bring it inside. We can talk a little bit more about it if you get worried. Watch for that. Larry, I'm listening. Tell me what's going on with your grass.
I had called you in July. Good morning. And we had talked about planting grass at a new place we have. And you said to call back in October for different types of grass.
That's right. So, you know, have you got plenty of sunlight?
Plenty.
Yeah. So the one grass I would tell you, I would really caution you not to grow is centipede. It does not grow very fast. It means it doesn't compete well with weeds. It doesn't recover from insect damage. It doesn't resist insect damage very well. You can't mow it as high as you like. It just causes all kinds of problems. So I will say avoid centipede. And the second thing I'll say is no grass is going to be perfect, particularly when you put it out over a large area. It's like saying, I got a bullseye. It's like every insect in the world, you're saying, look, come here. Here's a bunch of it. And it's all together, and you don't have to worry about it. It's just all right here, compact. And so it's going to be an attractant. So every grass is going to have a problem. Centipede is going to have more problems than most. I personally prefer St. Augustine. If it's a really poor soil, St. Augustine can do poorly. That means you really can then go to the other choice that you have are some of the new broad-bladed zoysias Not narrow-bladed zoysias, but broad-bladed zoysias. So
I would. People, they say they have some that's more hardy than St. Augustine. It grows in the shade and the sun. It's pretty vibrant grass, they claim.
Yeah, don't let them claim too much for it. It's an okay grass. I will tell you, it doesn't grow well in shade. St. Augustine probably grows better in shade. No grass grows well in shade at all. But St. Augustine probably does a little better in shade than most of the zoysias do. In zoysia, the one thing that zoysia has that I think is better than St. Augustine is that it is more resistant to wear. So particularly if you have dogs or if you have children or if you're walking across your lawn a lot in the same place, the zoysia is probably going to be a little bit better than the St. Augustine. In either case, make sure that you get a grass that you can mow very high. If you get a grass that, like the fine-bladed zoysias, that don't grow very fast and that stay very low, the weeds are going to eat you alive. So you want something that's a broad-bladed grass. St. Augustine or the zoysia can be fine. Both have problems. St. Augustine gets a disease called take-all occasionally on really dry sites so that's a problem. Now, the other thing we got to talk about is you got to spend a lot of money on this grass, and you don't want
to
redo it.
Well, I got a lot to plant as well, just around the house itself.
Yeah, so you want to do it right. One of the things you can do right now, if you want to, you could plant rye, and this is one way to think about it. If you've got way too much to do and you can't get it all done, you can plant rye right now, and it'll kind of give you a little bit of time to get the rest of it done. But the areas right around the house, I would go ahead and sod with either the St. Augustine or with the zoysia. Now, when you do it, let me give you a little recipe. First thing is, I'm going to have to do this quick, and you can call me back if you have any questions. But one, crack the soil. But what I mean by that is, and do this carefully, don't take a tiller. A tiller will just turn it into a fine little powder that will quickly recompact. It's like you undo everything good in the soil when you till it. Don't till it. Take a fork or a broad fork and crack it. What you want to do is you know what I'm talking about with a garden fork?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But the only thing I was thinking about that, I mean, I've got probably a half acre to do this in just around the house.
Yeah. So here's the other good thing is I would not sod a half an acre. I can't even fathom how you would want to do a half acre of sod. What a miserable thing you'd have if you had to mow all of that. But the big thing is sod the area close to your house. Get that done. On the other half acre, think about fun things to do. Think about where you're going to put your garden or where you're going to put your fruit trees or where you're going to put your longleaf pines or where you're going to put, find a corner where you're going to put water oaks and azaleas. Just anything besides trying to do a whole half acre in sod. That's going to be really hard. Concentrate your efforts, though, around your house. I need to come back. We'll have to come back after this break and talk about that in just a minute, about how to do that. We'll be right back.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's October. It's fall. The colors are beginning to change all over the state. The rain and the warm weather has delayed that change this year, but it's going to start now. You're going to see it. The black gum has already started. It's going to be really nice. The grasses are going to change too, and I don't think we recognize what a beautiful thing the fall color of grasses are. It's absolutely stunning, and you're going to hear me. I go on about it every year because I love the color of trees. I love the color of grasses. Our native grasses can have some incredible colors in fall. I mean, a field of native broom sedge is one of the most stunning things you've ever seen. That orange. And it is, you know, broom sedge just saves our hide every time. It is the grass that forgives us over and over, that helps us to reconnect with the landscape, to rebuild the landscape. If you want to rebuild a native habitat, you start with broom sedge. It's a great place to start. Incredible grass, incredibly important, and beautiful in fall. Orange, incredible. And little blue stem, these purple, reddish, plum purple stems of little blue stem right now. Oh, incredible. Big blue stem will do the same, even harder to find, but man, incredible. Incredible colors of grasses right now. The big sorghastrums, those purple flowers on the big sugarcane plume grasses. I don't know if you've seen those. Just amazing colors from the native grasses for fall. One thing to look for. The world is not made of trees. It's made of a combination of trees and grasses and wildflowers, legumes and orchids. Wonderful things. Many wonderful things out there. And finding a balance between them. Hey, Larry, so we're talking about a particular kind of grass now, which is the grass you're going to put in your lawn. So I have to do my disclaimer first, Larry. And Larry and I were talking. I think that a half acre of any grass, no matter what you choose, that's a lawn grass, is a perfect recipe for misery. I mean, you will always have problems with it. Always. And so start out. That's all I'm going to say, and I won't go on about it anymore. But start out around your house. That's where you need the grass the most. It's where you're going to be walking the most. It's where, you know, the best thing about grass is that you can walk on it. It should feel good under your feet. You should, when your brother comes to see you, you should tackle him and wrestle with him on the lawn. That's what lawns are for. And they're most useful around the house. And so put your effort into the area right around the house. And I'm going to tell you, when you do that, when you're planting this new grass, and this is the perfect time of year to do it. Boy, is it the great time of year to do it. It's going to take really easily. It's going to settle in. You can use St. Augustine. You can use the new broad-bladed zoysias. They go under several cultivar names. Either one can work, but prepare the soil correctly. And here's the thing. I would not recommend a tiller in the areas where you really want your grass to look good. The areas far away from your house where you don't have to look at the grass, you can do whatever you want to, whatever you have to get by. But right around your house, where you're going to be seeing the grass all the time, and it's going to bother you if it looks bad and if it gets holes in it, really put the effort there. Start with a broad fork or a garden fork and crack the soil. You're not turning it. You're not turning it upside down. You just stick it in, pull back, stick it in, pull back, stick it in, pull back. It builds a little bit of muscles, but, you know, muscles ain't going to hurt you. And it'll be good, and it makes all the difference in the world. You can do it really fast once you get started. And particularly in the areas close to your house, do that before you plant, it will keep that soil open without allowing it to recompact, which it has a tendency to do. Then come back after you've cracked it. Come back with about, particularly since this sounds like new ground, and it, you've probably got a lot of house construction debris around it, and a lot of compaction from the trucks and everything else. Come back with about 2 inches of pine bark. Just lay that pine bark right on top of the soil. You don't even need to dig it in. Just smooth it out. Water it if you want to water it so that it levels out, and then smooth it again. Add some lime to the top of it. Just sprinkle some lime over the top of it at about the directions that they've got on the package, which I'll have to think about what that is here in just a minute. But put the lime on top, and then put your grass on top of that, and it'll take off. You'll need to water it, of course, but it will really take off this time of year. And then you won't have to water it much. By December and January, it will have already set roots, and you'll be in good shape.
Okay, good. We've got a lot of that cracking to do. The pad for this house is probably 200 by 200.
Yeah, so, well, and so one thing you can do is, you'll do the best you can. I would say you could sow some of the area with rye. And certainly if I had a half acre, I'd be very tempted to sow half of it in rye. The rye is not going to persist through summer. But it'll hold the soil. It will make your mortgage holder happy. And you can go from there and move ahead on the house. And then in summer, you can come back and you can either sow the rye again next August, or you can wait and then try to expand the footprint of the area where you're putting in the sod. Probably underneath the rye, you're going to get things like bahia and other things coming in. Maybe you could even end up with things like, is it just bare dirt now?
Yeah, right on the pad it is. Our front yard's about 5 acres. So it's a mixture of centipede and bahia grass.
Bahia grass is annoying because it puts up those little seed heads, but on the other hand, it's not very close to you can let that bahia grass take over. It's going to be very hard to kill it back. So I might let the bahia grass take over those areas until you find something better to do with it.
Playing this bahia with a growth retardant so they don't go to seed heads.
Yeah. So you could continue to do that. Bahia is going to be really aggressive in all the areas where it's already existing. So it's going to be really hard to get rid of it to plant something else. So I might just go with the bahia there. And one of these days you're going to come back and say, God, you know, I bet there's more to life than bahia and zoysia grass. And find something good. I might even talk you into planting some fruit trees. You know, you could do that. Or you could plant a garden, or maybe you could plant some longleaf pines or other things where you don't have to manage the grass quite as intensively. But that's my thought. Work on the area around the house.
We have trees on this property, but they're young, except for one. I do own a piece of property that's got a live oak that's 21 feet around it. And it's had a crack in it for 40 years that I'm aware of.
Live oaks.
I looked at one the other day. Somebody said that they put a cable around that one that was cracked.
Yeah, live oaks grow really fast. And the good news about live oaks and the bad news about live oaks is that you won't have any grass under them as they grow taller. It won't matter what grass. Particularly up until they're about 40 or 50 years old, they really do exclude grass. So you can plan on those areas where the live oak grows up that you will not have much grass there in the long haul. They'll take over. And then you might think about, you know, what you can do in other places. But, yeah. But I would really work the area around the house, like as much as you can, the way I suggested. Yeah. Charlie's telling me it's time to break. You know, one of the problems with tillers is that they just pulverize the soil. They turn it into flour. And when that happens, it recompacts very quickly, which means the roots can't get back into it. It's a system that was designed for German soils, not for ours. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played. Waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian. Just across the line in a little southeast of Meridian. She loved your brother, I remember back when he was fixing up a 49 and in. He told her little sister gonna ride the wind up around the moon and back again. He never got...
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. You know, I guess it's a... Here's a recipe for being an unpopular garden columnist. Tell the truth. It's always a recipe for ultimate disaster. I got to be honest, and I'm going to be honest here, and I don't have to tell some people who listen a lot. I don't think, and I'll just give a warning, I don't think there's a good way to manage 5 acres of lawn. I think it always makes people unhappy. It will never work out perfectly. If you're out there trying to mow all of that constantly, multiple times per summer, the grasses that will persist there are going to be things like bahia, kogon grass, may, really nasty stuff. And you know, all of it's going to be problematic in one way or another. There's no way you want to sod more than a small area around your house. And I recommend sod. I think it's a great thing. I think St. Augustine sod, I think the new zoysia sods with the wide-bladed zoysias can be really great. They are great to walk across. They're great to roll on. They're great to have a picnic on. They're great to wrestle your brother on. Nobody seems to respond to that anymore. I guess nobody wrestles their brother anymore. So have we all gotten that old? Man, that's sad, isn't it? You know, that's what lawns are for. They're not for creating these huge lawns. Are not pastures. And so you've heard me say, I suspect, that when you get when you get out and you're really looking at a large area of 5 acres, that's pasture. That's something you maintain with a horse. I don't have a good way for maintaining it as a lawn. I wouldn't recommend it as a lawn because it's one of the most damaging things we can do. I think those large lawns that are managed that way are probably as damaging as almost anything we do in nature. They wipe out quail. They wipe out birds of all types. They wipe out, I mean, even deer have a hard time on a lawn that large. And deer are, you know, they're as close to really big rats as we've got. I mean, they eat anything, but they will even have a hard time on those large areas. So I just don't recommend thinking of a lawn as something that really spreads along a broad area. If you've got a small lawn, that's around your house, and you want it to, you want to walk from one place to another, you want to roll in it, you want to have all of the pleasure of feeling a lawn and laying down in a lawn, all of that I can help you with. I can't help you turn make a lawn out of a pasture. So that's, I just have to say that out loud every now and then. But on the other hand, I've got this great picture from Clay in Birmingham. My grandmother in Abbeville would sweep her porch with homemade broom sage. So broom sage, the great andropogon, the grass that saves our behind repeatedly. No, you can't make a lawn out of it. It makes a beautiful pasture, a stunning pasture with big orange pastures. There's a reason it's called broom sage, right? A broom sage, whatever you call it, sedge broom. I've heard it all those names. Sage broom, I've heard that too. Why is it called that? Well, because it made really good brooms, those bushy heads. And a lot of times that's what we traditionally made brooms out of. Clay, I respect you. I'm proud of you for holding on to that great broom sage tradition. Of making nice little brooms, nice little sweet brooms. And they are great brooms. Great for dusting with. Those are really great for dusting with. They're really fine textured. They're not too coarse. They're fine textured, so you can dust in delicate places with them. Lots of great things for broom sage. Rusty says, a big flush year for live oak acorns. Can you store them? Not really. Acorns have a short life. And they rot quickly. It's one of the problems with thinking about acorns as wildlife food. It's good, but each species of tree has a narrow window inside of which it produces acorns, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, when those acorns are actually good and good to eat for wildlife. And then they either germinate or they rot or get deteriorated or get bugs in them, in which case they can still be sort of good, but once they get bugs in them, they're going to decline pretty quickly. If you're a hunter and you want to understand trees, I mean, the best thing to understand is that if you think oaks are important for your deer, and they're sort of important, not hugely important, not nearly as important as people who didn't understand Alabama used to think, oaks are okay, but you need a lot of different kinds of oaks that produce acorns over a long period of time. One of the funny things is about sawtooth oaks, which is what everybody planted, because you know why everybody planted it, because their Deer magazine, they knew more about what they deer from the Deer magazine than they did about what was going on in the woods. You know, and the deer, I got to tell you a little secret. Deer don't read deer magazines. Deer don't look at deer video channels. You may not know this, but the deer don't do that. They've been living in these woods for a long time. They lived with what these woods provided, and that's what really makes them happy. It's what really makes them nutritious, eating a wide variety of things, not one thing, but many things throughout the year, hundreds of different things. That's what makes for healthy deer. That's where the protein comes from. That's where the calcium comes from. That's where all of the other things that deer need, it comes from these plants that they evolved to eat. And there were hundreds of different kinds. If you think acorns are important, and they are mildly important to deer this time of year, understand that you need acorns that provide food over a long period of time, because the acorns aren't viable. If you plant sawtooth oaks, they're going to produce their acorns at a time when there are plenty of other forage besides acorns. So the deer aren't going to actually go for the sawtooth oaks nearly as well as they're going to go for other types of forage. And it's not going to hold the deer in because the acorns produce too soon. Now, that's not what your deer magazine written in Minnesota said, is it? Or it's not what your magazine written in Kentucky said, is it? Because it's a different climate. But here, sawtooth oaks are less valuable. Understanding that is really important. But the deer, I want to tell you, the deer are out eating lots of other stuff right now. Lots of other stuff. So let's see. Somebody sent me a tree. Oh, man, I can't see those leaves. I'm going to think about it. Has big green fruit that falls off in late fall. As nearly as I can tell, looking at the growth, it looks like a pear. But, you know, if you can show me a picture of the fruit, I could probably tell a little bit better. It's a little far away. So beautiful, beautiful pictures of the longleaf preserve right now with all kinds of flowers. Some great, you know, that sunflower is looks like the coastal sunflower, Simulans, the great coastal swamp sunflower. The little blue flowers, Dan sent me, beautiful, beautiful stuff growing amongst those grasses. That is a that's a lobelia. I'm not sure which one, maybe Lobelia puberula. And then Dan, oh man, Dan, what a sweet thing. Dan picked them and put them in a jar and put them inside the house. Really nice looking stuff. Really, really nice looking stuff. Beautiful, beautiful sunflowers, beautiful, maybe a rudbeckia in there too, something with a pretty big cone in the center. Hey, we're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah. So, Josh, thanks, Josh. Feel like I'm a lone guy out there sometimes. So here's Josh. We were talking about acorns, talking about oaks and deer. Deer love acorns, no denying it, says Josh. But to your point, that's only a brief feast throughout the year. So Josh then says, you know, Josh sort of identifies why we get into trouble reading hunting magazines, just like we get in trouble reading garden magazines written in other places, when our climate is so different. They don't, you know, these magazines, they don't think about Alabama. The writers, and they're not being written by people who live in Alabama. And the people who live in Alabama who write for these magazines don't write about Alabama, or they wouldn't be employed by the magazine. That's the truth. So Josh says, one reason these hunting magazines probably espouse the virtue of oaks is because they are writing about areas with an earlier rut. If their rut coincides with the acorn drop, you have a huge doe magnet, and does draw the bucks. Our rut in South Alabama really peaks in February, well after the fall acorn drop is gone. So there it is. Deer eat acorns, there's no question. It is, they eat acorns for a few weeks out of the year. If you want to have acorns be part of their diet, you need to have a diversity of oaks, because the acorns will fall at different times. Some years will be better years for some trees than other trees. Could be a good year for white oak acorns, a good year for red oak acorns, and then within that you got 17 species of white oak, each one with a slightly different acorn drop, and maybe a big difference, maybe months apart in the acorn drop, and 23 species. Of red oaks in the red oak group with acorn drops that are wildly different. I mean, just crazy different. So you got to think about those things when you're thinking about it. I will say, so the question was, will wood ducks and mallards eat acorns? And yes, I think they probably do. And there's some evidence. It's funny. You'll hear arguments about whether ducks do or don't. There is some research that indicates if acorns are available, they will. But we also know that they're very particular about the kinds of acorns they eat. And they prefer some acorns much more than others. Are live oak acorns a preferred food for wood ducks and mallards? I don't know. I don't think it's worth storing them. I do think it's worth watching to see if any ducks that are here already are eating those acorns. One of the interesting things in the South is there's plenty to eat when the acorns fall. There's lots of other seeds. So we know that ducks love, stuff like holly berries, which are beginning to fall in those things. They eat that. They're eating lots of seeds from lots of plants, lots of grasses that are falling. Can be very important as duck food. Lots of other smaller seeds that ducks are clearly eating in these wetlands in fall, besides the acorns. Acorns, big fat things, obviously could be attractive, but not all acorns seem to be equally attractive. I wouldn't build my duck harvest around acorns or even my duck population. I think they play a role. I don't think, Rusty, that it would pay to save those acorns because so much will go wrong between now and then. It's a brief feast. It is a very brief feast. Is that what Josh said? That was Josh's words, a brief feast. And you got to live all year long. So that's one of the tricks. That is one of the tricks. I think they are some type of... I got to look at that, Dan. It's really interesting. I gotta look closely at those. Where'd you get them, Dan? Did you get them? Did you get them at the botanical gardens? They look more like coneflowers than sunflowers, but I gotta double check. That's interesting. It's not a pear, says Jerry from Fort Morgan, because it's round. Here's the problem, Jerry. Some pears are round. I didn't make them that way. Ain't my fault that not all pears look like pears. Some pears are round, and particularly some of the Asian pears can look a whole lot like apples. I gotta say, looking at those leaves and the fruit, it's still a little hard to see the fruit, but the leaves look a whole lot to me like pear fruit. The growth of the limbs looks a whole lot like pears. It's, you know, some people call them moon pears. It's an old name, but it's one of the Asian pears. Well, I guess most pears are Asian, honestly, but these are a group that we call Asian pears. They are, and they have fruit that is often not pear-shaped at all. That is, they don't have a narrow end and a big and a fat end. They will just be round. And I'm pretty sure that's what you got, is a pear tree. Definitely not a pawpaw. Pawpaw would be maybe a little taller than head high. It would have very distinctive, very long, longish leaves. And the fruits would look like, kind of like a baby banana, sort of. Like a peanut, except really a big, fat, green, yellow peanut. Smooth, unlike a peanut, but shaped like a peanut. So it's not a pawpaw for sure. It's a pear. I think we got a pear on our hands, Jerry. And it's just one of those round pears, which can be confusing if because we're sometimes used to grocery store pears only have a pear shape. Because if they didn't have a pear shape in the grocery store, you know what? Nobody would buy them. Because they'd think, oh, man, there's something wrong. That pear shape ain't shaped like the pears that they sell in the grocery store. And that's how we are. But there are lots of pears that are, in fact, round. And that's one of them. My wife, Dan T, says, let me go over here. I'm going to check real quickly. Yeah, we're caught up on callers. But Dan T says, my wife uses quite a bit of lemongrass in her cooking. Would it do okay? Boy, would it do okay growing down? You betcha. I grow lemongrass. I've been growing lemongrass for years. And it can be a lot of fun to grow it. It grows really well. It does not like a really wet place, but it is, it's tolerant of a high rainfall. It's more or less of a tropical grass. But yes, some year it survives in along the Gulf Coast. It survives the winter really well. I have even had lemongrass survive. I've seen it survive as far north as Montgomery and Birmingham and even Huntsville over the winter. Not every winter that far north, but it will often survive the winter if you cover it with something. If you throw leaves over it during the winter after it turns brown, you can uncover it when you need some lemongrass, because the roots will still be somewhat green, and it'll respring back up, and it'll come back up in spring, and it'll do great. So yes, Barry's asking me, could it be a mock orange? And no, it isn't. It's pretty clearly not a mock orange, Barry, because, it doesn't look like a mock orange. It doesn't have those little warty little things all over the fruits. You know how mock oranges are? If I guess that's what you mean by mock orange, which is what we would call in South Alabama and South Mississippi, bodock or bodark. Depending, which is from the French word bois d'arc, wood of the bow. It's not bodock, not Osage orange, not mock orange. It's a pear. I'm pretty sure. I can be wrong sometimes, but I think it's a pear. Pretty sure. You know, one of the ways to tell if you can get that fruit down, Jerry, try to get the fruit down. And it's going to have, the top of it's going to look a little bit like a pear. Slice into it. And just slice into that center. It looks like it's probably getting pretty ripe. Slice into it. Take a little slice and nibble at it. Nibble at the center. And if you don't die, it's a pear. I'm just kidding. You're not going to die. It's a pear. It's a good pear, too. It can be really delicious. It's, I don't know that it's my favorite pear, but it can be a very good pear. In fact, I volunteered to go pick some for my wife the other day on a neighbor's property who has one, and they don't pick it because they don't know it's a pear. So I said, well, I'll go over and pick you a pear from over here. They don't care. They don't care. Well, they do know it's a pear. But, it's a fun thing. It doesn't look like grocery store pears, so people think, well, it can't be a pear. But it is. Dan, I'm going to have to think about that in the lake in the pavilion. That could be planted, and I'm going to have to think about what those are. That one's a little bit worrisome to me because of that big tall cone in the center. I'm not sure what it is exactly. I'm going to think about it carefully. It just seems like a bigger cone than I would normally be used to on a sunflower. But I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it real hard, Dan. Wish I had the leaves on that one. Is that the same one So the one that's growing wild is clearly a sunflower that I see in the upper part of the picture. The one that is growing in the one that's in the container has a black center and seems different. So you'll have to tell me if they're the same thing before I make a fool of myself anymore. Alicia, I'm gonna address your question. Just as soon as I get through with this break, can you speak to planting strawflower poppies? Strawflower poppies. I'm thinking about what a strawflower poppy is. Strawflowers, I understand. Poppies, I understand. I got to think about either one. I've been thinking a lot about poppies lately, so we'll talk a little bit about that when I come back. It's a great question. We're going to go to break. And we're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. We don't have much time, so you got to call quick.
Six foot, 7 foot, 8 foot, punch.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alicia, you're about to get me in trouble with the DEA. Alicia didn't put a comma in there. I go, what the heck is a straw flower poppy? And I determined that, I can't tell you what I determined. I hope the DEA isn't following my my searches. Alicia wants to know how to grow straw flowers and poppies. You know, I don't have a lot of experience growing straw flowers. I would think it's going to be a fall planted thing. It's more of a dry climate thing, and I think they're going to function much like overwintering annuals. Dan, I got you. So you got our native sunflower Helianthus angustifolia. Good. But listen, Alicia, straw flowers, I don't know. You have to experiment. I think they're – my sense is they're not going to do well here. I will be honest, I haven't grown them. But I think they're going to be a little tough, and I think they're not going to like our wet springs. But poppies, I have tried many times. Poppies were a traditional crop in the South for reasons that, because it was medicine. And so we did grow poppies. I have seen a lot of old yards. In fact, there is a famous old story which goes way back, where I got called by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, for writing about growing poppies. And it was a funny conversation. It was an interesting conversation. Someday you'll have to call me and ask me when we have time to talk about it. We'll talk a little bit more about it. But it was almost amusing, except a little scary. But poppies were traditionally grown here. And the DEA has kind of backed off. They're not persecuting people for growing poppies anymore. They tried for a while. But they were grown as medicinal things. Traditional opium poppies, which were grown for flowers. You see them in many old gardens. There are people who grow them really well. Robin grows them really well. I never understand what the secret is. I mean, she does a great job growing poppies. My poppies, they never... very few germinate. And I guess once you get them established and you get it established in the right ground, but they really like to germinate in really gritty soil. They don't like wet soils. So really dry, gritty soils are good for poppies. You need to sow them in fall. There is no question. There really is no other time to sow poppies except in the fall in the South, as nearly as I can tell. That is traditionally the way I was taught to grow them. It's the way when I've had my limited success with poppies, that's the way I grew them. Part of the reason I think I don't have great success with poppies is I didn't have soil that was gritty enough, that was coarse enough. I think if you have really sandy soil, you're more likely actually to get germination. And by sandy, I mean like you can actually see the crystals. And some soils are like that, so that really like gritty, kind of almost rocky, gravelly soils. They'll germinate well in gravelly, rocky, gritty soils. That's the trick. Now, the problem is, of course, with poppies is not only do they like gritty soils, they also like lots of nutrients. So then when they get started in these gritty, gravelly soils, which don't have a lot of nutrients in them, then you've got to figure out how to get them fertilized and grow up. And to be fair, poppies are the kind of plant we associate with Afghanistan. So if you think Mobile isn't much like Afghanistan, you have discovered something that is quite accurate. We don't have the same conditions, but poppies have been grown here. Now, so you can try it. This is the time of year to do it. I think California poppies don't do well at all, at least in my experience. I've not had a great success with them Flanders poppies, I haven't had success with. Maybe somebody else has. Opium poppies did well overwintering, and in some cases, with the right soil, in the right conditions, if you can get those seeds to germinate and if you can get enough seeds. There it is. Why does Alabama have... Dan, you just tickle me that you're always going to ask the right... why do we have so many sunflower species? We don't know. And in fact, I'm working with a guy. I'm working with Brian Keener, and I'm... Brian's is the taxonomist at University of West Alabama. And I bother the stew out of Brian. I mean, I drive him crazy. Because I say, Brian, I've never seen this sunflower before. What kind of sunflower is this? And he says, I don't know. Why do you keep bothering me? I think we got more sunflowers than we even know about. But we've been discussing whether Alabama's the center of sunflower diversity. Why? I think because of the savannas. And you know, this is a great way to end the show, isn't it, Dan, to talk about these savannas. You know, trees are really important to Alabama. Alabama is the center of tree diversity, really, by almost any measure in North America. We're the greatest concentration of oak diversity. You go down the Red Hills, up in the Red Hills, however you want to look at it. You go up in the Red Hills, and right there around Monroe County, Choctaw County, Clark County, I mean, you can have a hillside that's going to have between 25 and 30 species of oaks on basically on one hillside. Incredible diversity. A huge 7 species of magnolias on one hillside. I don't even want to guess at the number of hickories. Incredible diversity that can occur in Alabama for trees. But, you know, much of Alabama's diversity isn't trees at all. And so we're the center of sunflower diversity. And sunflowers, there's an operative word here, sun. There ain't many sunflowers that like growing under the shade of a live oak. They like full sun. Sunflowers do. And we seem to be the center of sunflower diversity. And I think that says something about how our forests used to be. They were not these thick thickets of live oaks that we see now. Live oaks were restricted. They were only in a few areas and beautiful in those areas, mostly along coastal strands. Most of our forests were savanna, a great combination, a kind and congenial combination of trees and grasses and wildflowers. And if you understand that much of Alabama was that way, with plentiful rainfall, plentiful sunshine, and lots of different soil types all throughout the state, then you begin to understand, gosh, you know, this could be the center of sunflower diversity in the world, and probably is. We don't brag on the things we ought to brag about, but I think we're the sunflower capital of the world. There it is. Not of North America, not of the United States, the sunflower capital of the world. I cannot find another place with a greater concentration of sunflowers than Alabama. Absolutely amazing. Now, somebody in, it ain't California, that's for sure. Not Texas, that's for sure. Doesn't seem to be Georgia. Not South America, that's for sure. Not Asia. It's Alabama. It's Alabama. Something to think about. How do we make room for all of these species, the sunflowers and the trees, understanding savannas, understanding trees aren't angels. They're just fellow travelers. Hey, we're going to be back next week. Give us a call.
Keeps on raining, levee's going to break.